Welcome back. This is Geography 130, Lecture 22, and it is the last lecture. Today, I want to talk briefly about the article that you read for today, Amartya Sen's Population, Delusion, and Reality. I suggested last time that this summarizes the empirical conclusions of the course, although focusing, you know, rather narrowly on population, or not of all the things we've looked at, but nonetheless, it's a good summary, I think. And then I'll spend most of the time trying to summarize what I think we've learned this semester and arrive at some conclusions. Before I go further, I told you last time I would put this in a slide, but then I failed to do it, so I brought the actual schedule along. The final exam will take place Thursday, May 13th from 3 to 6 p.m. And I have been told that it is in 145 and 160 Duinel. Does anybody know if those two rooms connect or otherwise? They don't. All right, yeah? I see. People might be randomly assigned such that you should just read whatever your bare facts tells you and go to that room. All right. This introduces some wrinkles because, hi, Lynn, how are you? I guess it follows that we will need one GSI in 145, another one in 160. And for those of you who are DSP students, we have reserved 575 McCone, the seminar room on the fifth floor of McCone, for you to take the exam. So I guess I will also be proctoring, assuming that my partner is not in labor at that point in time. Thank you. Yeah, it's been interesting to teach a course on population as the pregnancy has advanced. The due date is the 14th, so who knows? I guess I'll figure that out. All right, any questions about that? Or the, not about my imminent child, but about the final exam or other housekeeping matters? Oh, the papers. The GSIs are not going to be able to get those papers back to you today, obviously. They will be graded before the final exam. And if you wish to get your paper back before the final, you should email your GSI and work out an arrangement for that. Okay? All right. So, what have we got? I asked you to read this piece by Amartya Sen from the New York Review of Books back in 1994. Amartya Sen won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1998. He is particularly renowned for his contributions to the field of welfare economics, which broadly speaking might be described as economics that attempts to address welfare broadly understood rather than reduced to questions of, say, GDP or simply income, that kind of thing. Trying to look at the interactions between economics and poverty, famine, mortality, disease, generalized conditions of living. In 1999, he published an article called Democracy as a Universal Value, in which he made the statement, "No substantial famine has ever occurred in any independent and democratic country with a relatively free press." This is a statement that I believe Mike Davis would endorse. In other words, that famine is not reducible to questions of food supplies, it is intimately bound up with institutional arrangements and particularly government and freedom, that if a country is democratically governed and has a relatively free press, that ways of dealing with food shortages can be found and have been found. Now, summarizing his arguments, I don't know how much detail we want to go into on the specific evidence that he reviews, but we might summarize his arguments broadly and then discuss those as we need. He says the population problem is serious, but neither because of the proportion between the natural increase of population and food, which is lifted from that line, Malthus, nor because of some impending apocalypse, the emergency mentality based on false beliefs in imminent cataclysms leads to breathless responses that are deeply counterproductive. So he's not only saying that there is not some kind of cataclysm that can be attributed to population growth, but that efforts mobilized around or by that type of apocalyptic prediction, in fact, are counterproductive, that they can make matters worse rather than better, even in their own terms, in terms of population growth rates. So he's not denying that this is a serious issue. He's speaking to how we might go about best addressing it. And he runs through a broad variety of instances from various levels, from state levels to nation levels to continental or regional levels, looking at the numbers and basically concluding that if you want to slow the rate of population growth, bring down fertility levels, what you should do is not try to stop people from having babies, but address other needs that people have. Address mortality rates. Reduce the death from diseases, for example. Reduce infant mortality. Raise life expectancy. That might appear to keep more people alive and therefore increase population, but as we've seen, it also actually has the effect of making it more likely that people will choose to have fewer babies. He focuses very much on education, particularly female education, and suggests that the best way to bring down fertility rates is to put people in a situation where they not only prefer to have fewer children, but are able to do so. And this correlates very well, he suggests, with giving women more opportunities for education, opportunities for work, opportunities for political representation and activism, all of these things, giving them access to health care, access to contraception, so that they can take some control or have greater control over not only their decisions about reproducing, but their livelihood chances as a whole. He doesn't specifically say that inequality leads to population growth, but he does suggest that we can't properly evaluate these claims about the damages of population without thinking about inequality. He says one additional American typically has a larger negative impact on the ozone layer, global warmth, and other elements of the Earth's environment than dozens of Indians and Zimbabweans put together. Those who argue for the immediate need for forceful population control in the third world to preserve the global environment must first recognize this elementary fact. And we have seen this as well over the course of the semester, the radical disparities in consumption rates around the world make the developed world's populations an order of magnitude greater impacting on the environment on a per capita basis than the people in the third world, generally speaking. And to that extent, if you're worried about the global environment, it might make sense to worry most about the people in the wealthier parts of the world. Those also happen to be the people who have, generally speaking, lower birth rates, lower rates of population growth, which might signal that you don't need to address or worry about, you shouldn't prioritize their rates of population growth per se. You should just focus directly on questions of consumption. You had a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering, like, the argument that just like less impactful, like a third world country is less impactful.
Right. No, he doesn't say that. In fact, he explicitly cautions against reaching that conclusion. I mean, he acknowledges that rates of economic growth are actually higher in the poorer parts of the world, and that as those countries get wealthier and populations there increase their consumption on a per capita basis, certainly that will be what multiplied, so to speak, by their populations, and mean that their populations will have some kind of proportional effect on the environment. Here, I think he's specifically trying to address the environmental arguments about population growth, and particularly those that are global in scale, right, rather than local or regional environmental threats. And he's simply saying, you know, if you're concerned about population as a driver of global environmental decline, then you have to interpret it through actual consumption rather than simply gross population numbers. Yeah. Could you make the argument along the lines of Lychenko and Solecki from earlier in this semester that the exporting of the American dream as a sort of pattern or template for consumption patterns in the third world will mean exponential rate of growth in the consumption of peoples in the third world as they grow wealthier? I would agree with that, except possibly the use of the term exponential. That gets into some tricky questions about exactly what that effect would be. But certainly, if the model for consumption around the world is the American model in terms of land use, in terms of resource consumption, yes, certainly that will mean greatly magnified overall resource effects or impacts from the people who will have that lifestyle at some point in the future or who want that lifestyle, compared to if they didn't achieve that lifestyle. But to turn that into an argument for forcibly preventing them from aspiring to that lifestyle does seem, I can't remember which author it was who made the point that basically it's just ethically indefensible, right? I think it was one of the newspaper articles that, you know, we can't possibly, it's sheer hypocrisy to say that the rest of the world somehow should be prevented from following this model, even as we obviously continue to follow it ourselves. I would be all in favor of another model, but okay. He cautions very strongly against what we might call demographic reductionism, the tendency to interpret all manner of environmental ills, or for instance, I mean, the nobody dies from overpopulation argument that Garrett Hardin made about the cyclone in Calcutta, that somehow it's all about population numbers, right? He says many causal factors affect the degree of deprivation in particular parts of a country, rural as well as urban. And to try to see them as all as resulting from overpopulation is the negation of social analysis. It is a refusal to actually seriously look at the problem rather than a useful diagnosis of it or understanding of it. To simply insist on population as somehow what matters or what underlies everything else that matters, is, he says, the negation of social analysis, which I think we might just call the negation of good thinking. So, do we need to go into more detail about Sen's arguments, his arguments about different states in India, his arguments about China compared to India? Are there questions about that? He very systematically works his way through the various arguments that are out there about, I mean, at the end of the day, his analysis is about what is more effective, a coercive or what he calls override approach, in which the reduction of population growth is pursued through various ways of overriding people's individual preferences. Overriding either directly by, for instance, making it illegal to have more than one child, or doing it through various kinds of economic compulsion. The payments for sterilization in India would be an example, creating a general economic and political situation in which people feel like they have a lot to lose if they don't go along with reducing their fertility. They might lose housing. They might lose education. All of those approaches he characterizes overriding approaches. He also suggests this should be applied to those who would advocate prioritizing family planning over all other kinds of public investment in the third world, right? If you say, you know, you've got to give your money, your public money has got to be invested in family planning, even if that means taking funding away from schools or from healthcare or from other kinds of public investment, that too, he suggests, is an overriding approach in which you are essentially trying to force people or constrain people to reduce their fertility. So he contrasts all of those with a more voluntary or collaborative approaches that are aimed at working with people's decisions, with their own sense of their interests and ambitions and desires for how many children they would have. And he suggests that there is no evidence that the coercive overriding approaches are more effective. He disentangles the evidence comparing China with other parts of the developing world and suggests that the one child rule in China actually may have been not a significant contributing factor to declining fertility there compared to other things going on in China during the time, including economic growth, literacy, education, social services of other kinds, right? So he suggests that's not some kind of evidence in favor of coercive approaches. And he compares different states in India. You can read this. It's all, I think, extremely clearly laid out. Are there any questions or concerns or thoughts about Amartya Sen's argument? Yeah. That's true. That's exactly correct. And that's, in fact, one of the points he's making, that if you just look at China and say, well, it must be the one-child policy, you are, in fact, ignoring a lot of other things that are going on at the same time. It's not a controlled experiment. It's not replicated. You aren't necessarily really getting the signal from the one-child policy separate from these other developments. He also points out, for instance, that investments in these broader social services, such as education and healthcare, are actually affordable even in poor parts of the world, precisely because the price of labor in poor parts of the world tends to be very low. These are services that are labor-intensive, providing teachers, providing nurses, that kind of thing. And to that extent, if you are in a place where the price of labor is very cheap, you can afford this. And he points to examples of states that are not wealthy but have managed to provide these services and have seen reductions in fertility correlate with those investments and improvements in things like literacy rates, particularly for women. So where are we at then? We come to the end of this, and I've got some slides here that we have seen before that I want to go back and use as a kind of way of summarizing what we've seen this semester. This one from early in the semester, the graph here of total world population in the developing world and the industrialized world from 1750 out to a projected 10 billion total around 2050. The sharp spike in population growth, particularly in the developing world after 1950, the much slower rate of growth in the industrialized countries. We suggested that there was a need to understand this upturn in the total rate of growth. We've seen a variety of reasons that might explain that, right? The Green Revolution in particular, the delayed second part of the demographic transition, in other words, declines in mortality that were lagged significantly, they came significantly before declines in fertility. This might be associated with differential arrival of the more rapid arrival of technologies to prevent mortality, that kind of thing. These are things that we might want to try to explain and might do a lot to help us understand this increase. This graph down here, charting population and production globally over the last 1,000 years. Obviously, the way you choose to calibrate this scale is important, but pointing to a cross point, a point of inflection around the end of the 19th century, when you see the rate of production go up significantly faster. It actually begins somewhat earlier with the Industrial Revolution. World population does increase its growth rate, but not as quickly as the growth in production. And this is something that Sen, again, actually discusses and details, whether you're looking at food production or whether you're looking at overall economic activity. The rate of growth in production has exceeded the rate of growth of population, and to that extent, arguments about some kind of economic shortages that must inherently flow or follow from population growth are not borne out empirically. He does also say that doesn't mean they might not be borne out in the future, right? He does acknowledge that just because this has been the pattern in the past is no guarantee that it will continue to be the pattern in the future. But he suggests that there is no need to cry that the sky is falling now, right? That such a sort of cataclysm of shortages is not imminent in the near future. Now, I suggested earlier in the semester that it was worth asking in the connection with figures such as these whether we're really dealing with a single population for the world, as suggested by these graphs, or whether, in fact, what this consists of is a multitude of populations located in different parts of the world whose collective behavior is not necessarily tractable or coherent in relation to things like production or natural resource decline, right? That, in fact, the world is not made up of, is not a single human habitat, at least not in a lot of ways that matter. It is a whole bunch of different habitats. And here again, Sen alludes to this as well, that just because you have overall rates of food production or economic growth that are positive on a per capita basis doesn't mean that you don't also have pockets where the pattern is in fact reversed, smaller scale areas where there may or may not be per capita economic growth, per capita growth in food production. And he points to places like Africa and says, you know, these are areas where, yes, the population growth rate is faster than the economic growth rate. And to that extent, you see negative trends in per capita income. But he also points out that even had Africa during that time period had lower fertility, lower population growth rates, you still would not have seen a great deal of economic growth. And to that extent, it's not simply, you can't attribute the slow economic growth to rapid population growth, right? He says, no, Africa's problems are not its population growth rate. Africa's problems are its political problems, its economic problems, its larger problems of corruption, problems of war, and that sort of thing. So they are broader problems of development, and that's the context in which we ought to think about these problems, not focus on population per se. So, what should we conclude for the semester as a whole? The global scale. In what sense is the global scale the right one to think about these problems? And in what sense is it not? Two of the topics we have discussed here, biodiversity being one of them, and world population being another, are both indexes that imply a global scale. They are useful, I would say, only if there are, in fact, global scale processes or mechanisms that drive or reflect explain what is measured. It only makes sense to talk about these global metrics if you can actually provide some kind of mechanism that connects those global metrics to processes that we can reasonably assert are global in scale. Right? We need some kind of mechanism that actually has an effect on global population in a way that's not, you know, hopelessly confounded and mediated by other factors, or on biodiversity, right? I would suggest that global warming and globalization of both production and consumption do in fact meet this standard. They do represent processes that are not only global in scale, but are meaningfully global in scale. These are, however, relatively new phenomena associated with the last 50 years, last 40 years perhaps in the case of globalization. Global warming obviously goes back further, but as far as its present, our understanding of it and the rates at which emissions of greenhouse gases are going up, this also is principally something we should be thinking about in terms of the last 50 or 60 years. To that extent, we might reasonably say, yes, global population, global biodiversity are in fact meaningful measures of something worth considering at that scale. Now, at the end of the day, though, the emission of greenhouse gases is highly uneven and is not simply a global thing. Their effects are a global thing. But their emissions, where they come from and how much from where, are regional, local, even extremely local types of phenomena. The plowing, the bulldozing of this piece of desert released CO2 to the atmosphere. Similarly, impacts to environments or habitats for biodiversity are always local or regional in their actual impacts. The decisions that drive them are unavoidably mediated at local scales. And so if we are worried about land use, for example, we should be looking to act at the scales at which these processes actually unfold. There is an incredible amount that can be done at the local and regional level to reduce the rates of greenhouse gas emissions. How people's houses are laid out, how big those houses are, determines how much energy they use to heat the houses, how far they drive to work every day. We see that the pattern of urban growth in New York City in the second half of the 20th century, and this is true for most cities, large cities in the United States, is one in which the suburbs grew and the inner city did not. What you got was much, much greater growth in the overall area of cities than you got in their populations. And these decisions are made at the county, local, and state levels, right? The capital underwriting them may come from someplace else, but the relevant jurisdiction for determining whether a suburb gets built like this is ultimately a local one. Many of the most promising efforts that have been marshaled thus far to address greenhouse gas emissions in the United States are, in fact, local, municipal, or county-scale efforts. And, of course, it won't actually address the problem unless it happens across lots and lots and lots of these localities. But the actual decisions are, in large measure, local decisions. Yeah. Right. No, that's a very good point. It's not to say that the people making these local decisions are somehow all-powerful in the face of broader factors, broader forces, global markets, that kind of thing. It's simply to say that these are decisions. I mean, the relevant scale at which to focus your efforts, if you want to do something about reducing greenhouse gas emissions, is not only the global scale. That's what I'm trying to say. And in fact, there are examples out there of smaller scale entities that have successfully done this. I don't know how many of you know very much about Portland, but Portland has managed to keep its emissions flat even as its population has grown. That's still a long way away from reducing them, I admit. But it's actually something of an accomplishment. It started 35 years ago, right? And it took a lot of very active, very foresighted political mobilization at that local level to put in place those types of constraints on growth and efficiency requirements and things like that. I mean, they've even gone so far as to force the local utility to start sourcing its energy from less emissions-intensive sources, right? They're investing in a massive solar field and targeted specifically to the Portland municipal area. Another conclusion worth bringing out from the semester, touching on the question of coevolution. Obviously, human-environment interactions are complex. The most important interactions, it appears, tend to be nonlinear across scales. So if we're thinking about the interaction between a municipal body or a county level decision about land use and the broader global or national or regional dynamics of climate change or markets, it would be a mistake to assume that there's some kind of simple linear relationship, right? It's not adequate to assume that, well, we'll just reduce our emissions right here and everyone else will eventually do it too, and then the problem will be solved. These nonlinear relations across scales require a great deal of more careful and nuanced thinking and pose a lot of really challenging and interesting problems for any kind of analysis of human-environment interactions. The coevolution part here simply meaning that this is a dialectical relationship between human communities and the environments that they live in. The impacts that they have on them, the way that they modify them, the tools that they have available. You must recognize that dialectical complexity. And it follows from that that any rules you happen to discern, patterns that you see strongly evidenced for a particular place and time, are likely to be geographically and historically specific. That you cannot simply assume that because they are true here, now, they will be true there tomorrow, or even here tomorrow. The Industrial Revolution has been termed, or has been this new epoch, the Anthropocene epoch, a term coined by geologists to refer to the period since the invention of Watt's steam engine, literally pinpointed to that invention, signaling that the world is now driven on a global geological scale of time and space by humans. To what extent this is accurate is open to debate. To what extent it's useful is also open to debate. But that's the kind of, again, the kind of reality that we are now forced to think about. And it speaks to these issues of when should we think globally, or how can we meaningfully understand these problems globally? What kinds of scales are involved? How do we tease apart more local and larger scale phenomena and processes and try to make sense of it overall? Here, I think it's not, instead of focusing on Watt and his steam engine, it seems to me that we would be more, we would be better suited, better served to think about it in terms of what we termed accumulation and appropriation. And here, drawing on Adam Smith, perhaps we should date this Anthropocene not to Watt, but to the wealth of nations. I mean, it's as good as any, right? In that early and rude state of society which precedes both the accumulation of stock and the appropriation of land, that original state of things which precedes the appropriation of land and the accumulation of stock. Perhaps this is the key turning point that signals this growth in productivity, growth in population, and arguably the advent of the Anthropocene epoch. In other words, this is not so much about the steam engine as what the steam engine was both a symptom of and an important cogwheel in, which is the development of industrial capitalism. The general law of capitalist accumulation, according to Marx, the battle of competition is fought by the cheapening of commodities. The cheapness of commodities depends, all other circumstances remaining the same, on the productivity of labor. And this depends on the scale of production. Therefore, the larger capitals beat the smaller. And I zeroed in on the organic composition of capital, and we talked about the shrinking peasants and the growing tractors as a kind of symbolic illustration of this. But going back, the key thing then becomes the scale of production. And we can think about the growing impact of humans on the earth and its natural resources in terms of the scale of production, both spatially and temporally, and in terms of simple magnitudes, right? This, I believe, is ultimately how we should read the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. This is about industrial capitalism. And that is what drives the system that is most important to understanding the human relation to the environment today. Just my opinion. We can see this in Livibacci. Population and real wages in England, 1550 to 1850. He says the difficult balance between population and land was broken as economic and demographic growth became not competing but complementary forces, rather than, as in the past, inflections back and forth, where if you have falling wages and rising population, they eventually cross and reverse. Suddenly, as of the 19th century, you see this remarkable shift in which both go up together. This is a decoupling that is obviously related to what Marx called the metabolic rift. It has all kinds of environmental consequences. It is presumably, or as far as I can tell, what changed in the late 19th century, or the mid to late 19th century, and what has driven the dynamics, obviously inflected in all kinds of complicated ways at local scales, but driven the dynamics of the system as a whole ever since. So it becomes a question here of how much of the world is a part of the market and how much remains beyond or outside of the market. And here we mean specifically the market as driven by competition and economies of scale and production as described by Marx. This rather complicated depiction can be interpreted in a number of different ways. If we start with the premise that nature does in fact produce things that are of value to us, they can be harvested or removed and sold into a market. This cycle obviously can repeat within certain limits. Those limits are not fixed. Those limits are a function of all kinds of both ecological and social, technological, economic factors and constraints, right? Beyond those limits, wherever they may lie at any given point in time, a resource will become scarce, and this, in a market setting, will cause those prices to go up. And this can lead to the development of substitutes or the development of technologies that can cycle back, and what you have got is a growth of the market relative to the world and realm of non-marketed or outside the market goods, right? Perhaps you have greater efficiency. Perhaps you have just found a substitute resource. You have depleted one fishery and you move to the next, that kind of thing. And what would appear to be happening then is expansion of the reach of the market and a decline in the relative part of the world that is not brought into these market dynamics. So you see a growth in that which is private or commodified relative to that which is public or free. And this, I think, is an interesting way of thinking about what's happened over the past 100 to 200 years and thinking about all the things that we buy and sell in markets today that were not bought and sold in markets, say, 100 years ago. The degree to which we depend on and participate in the market for a growing share of our needs and our activities, a kind of commodification of more and more and more of not just the world, not just nature, but our time and our lives as well. The supposed solution offered by some, the green governance paradigm that would commodify virtually all of this in order to internalize externalities, is a dominant, perhaps the dominant, proposed approach in a lot of policy circles these days. And it's getting a lot of attention from a lot of scientists as well, as we've seen, including the folks who did the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, all types of economists, that kind of thing. Or at least, well, not all types of economists. A lot of them are just ignoring this altogether. But those economists who are concerned about this are largely rallying around this kind of model. And intuitively, in theory, this appears to be a fairly promising way of going, because it's certainly true that a lot of profits are secured by externalizing costs and passing on the negative impacts of various production activities either to the state or to innocent bystanders, right? But this approach fails, I believe, to address these two questions. First, what if ecosystem breakdowns actually generate economic activity and growth, as well as the other way around? What if those breakdowns are in fact helpful to the continued accumulation of capital, precisely by making scarce things that were not scarce before, and thereby bringing them into the realm of things that can be priced and subject to scarcity? Secondly, what if natural capital doesn't actually become capital until it isn't working anymore? What if the breakdown of the provision of free goods, whether it's clean air and water, or whether it's the pollination activities of insects, you name it, what if you don't really have an opportunity, you can't really make it into a capital, a form of capital, until it's not working that way anymore? In other words, what if the idea of natural capital as a concept that you can extend to the entire global ecosystem is in fact a flawed understanding of capital itself, a kind of idealized fiction that, try as you might, does not, in fact, lend itself to these kinds of marketizing, commodifying schemes that are the focus of so much work these days. We have seen this pattern in a number of empirical cases in which the state, or the disorganized public, perhaps, is left to pick up the pieces from downturns, whether they are economic or ecological, whereas the market takes the profits as private return on investment whenever things are going well. The green governance paradigm seems to think that these parts down here can be flipped up, can be somehow turned into positives both for the environment and for the state, or that the state can create a regulatory regime in which these things, in fact, come up above the line and become sources of profit, and thereby sources or mechanisms for optimizing the distribution of things. And this, it seems to me, just flies completely in the face of what we have seen thus far, in addition to the problems just mentioned about whether you can really do these things, set up these metrics and markets and so forth. So rather than conceiving of sustainability in terms of various kinds of capital, human capital, social capital, natural capital, so on and so forth, trying to imagine that you can calculate a figure, a number for each of these kinds of capital, and then define sustainability in relation to that aggregate, or in relation to one of them as opposed to the others, right? Renewable natural capital, for example. Rather than imagining that these things can be calculated in this way, it seems to me that we would be better off defining sustainability in this way, and this is a slide from a previous lecture. The harvesting of products from a system and the discarding of waste into a system without exceeding critical thresholds, that is, without surpassing the resilience of the system as defined by the interacting processes that generate the products and absorb the wastes. Now, I realize that this perhaps puts too much weight on this term resilience, and it puts us in a position of not really being able to predict when those critical thresholds will be passed. We may be able to look at examples from the past that suggest the existence of these thresholds, and maybe even give us some kind of measurements of where they happen to lie at the point when a system crashed in the past. But that gives us no reliable prediction as to where those thresholds might lie in the future, or whether they will lie in the same place in another place than where they were in the instance that we happen to be able to study. In other words, this is not something that gives us a predictive framework by which to guide our future actions, right? And to that extent, we are thrown back on a precautionary principle type of approach in which we must, wherever we can, err on the side of precaution and moderation and not assume that everything is, you know, somehow predictable. So, a handful of conclusions that we might finish with here. First, population is not an independent variable with respect to natural resources. We can count the number of people and we can estimate their impacts. But to think that the number of people is somehow the driving factor in the effects we see on natural resources by humans is mistaken. More often, it is a dependent variable rather than an independent variable. It changes in response to other things. It does not change those other things in some kind of simple, independent, reliable way. In general, I would say population is a bad abstraction. And here I borrow from Andrew Sayre, who defines a bad abstraction this way. A bad abstraction arbitrarily divides the indivisible and or lumps together the unrelated and the inessential, thereby carving up the object of study with little or no regard for its structure and form. And this, I would say, is true of population, at least insofar as it's been applied to the broad question of humans and natural resources. It's just not a helpful place to start thinking about these problems. It's not irrelevant. It's not something that we shouldn't think about at all, but it's not a helpful place to start, and it should not be the first and foremost consideration in our minds when we think about the environment and natural resources. And no, this is not just a rationalization for the fact that I'm having a child. In other words, other variables and other theories are more important and valuable than population, and there are a number of them that we've come across this semester. Household size and number is a better candidate. Education, health, and equity are better candidates if we are concerned about the environment. Capital accumulation, circulation, and distribution are all better candidates for where we should start our thinking if we are concerned about these issues. The built environment is perhaps the single most tractable place to start thinking about these questions. Insofar as the built environment mediates production, mediates consumption, and sets in place landscapes, humanly modified landscapes, that have incredibly enduring effects. Once those cities and buildings and highways and railways and communication systems and farm fields are in place, they are backed by the interests of the investors who paid for them, whether that is private entities or the public. Most of those investments are expensive. People will fight to protect the value that they have invested, the money that they have invested in these things. They do not want to see that value vanish. Once they are in place, they must continue to return on that investment over long periods of time, if only to enable the debt holders to pay off those debts, right? And that applies to homeowners paying off mortgages. It applies to corporations paying off their bonds. It applies to cities and governments paying off their bonds. Everywhere you see an indebted investment, you are likely to see something that is going to persist into the future. And perhaps the simplest, most powerful example right now are decisions we make about investments in energy, right? These are power plants and transmission systems that will be there for 50 years or more, and they will have an incredible inertial effect on the way we influence the environment and the way we produce things, the way we live going forward. And finally, knowledge and innovation are also better places to focus our attention or start our thinking. The point I was trying to make last time, which I don't think I quite clearly made, about Harvey's argument regarding relationality, the need to recognize our ideas as themselves socially determined products of the societies that we live in, and that those ideas, because of their dynamism, because they change in ways that are not predictable and not easily modeled, has to be internal to our thinking about these problems. Technology is always invoked as this kind of wild card that has the potential to either make things much worse or perhaps solve any problem that might arise, right? And technology is an incredibly powerful and important variable. But knowledge more generally and innovation more generally in things and their effects on social organization, the way we organize and thinking about sen, whether a society is democratic or not, may be more important than the level of technology that's available to those people at that point in time for producing things. And innovations in social organization that stem from experiments and stem from thinking that is not just about technology but is more broadly understood are incredibly important and need to be valorized as such within these types of debates. So finally, tying these threads together, I think we can safely say that global warming threatens to exceed thresholds of resilience in ecological systems at all scales. We don't know just where those thresholds are. We don't know how many positive feedbacks, nonlinear interactions might get involved in this or when. But I think it's safe to say that this is a global process that is not sustainable and that will have repercussions pretty much everywhere. At the same time, globalization threatens to make the world's population into a single reserve army of the unemployed. I think that is a fairly apt way of thinking about large parts of the global human population. And this global process is, like global warming, likely to be unsustainable at a number of different scales. Finally, nonetheless, these threats, I believe, can be confronted at scales other than the global. We can't lose sight of the global scale in efforts to address them, but we should not let the global scale be the only one at which we are acting or thinking. Are there any questions? Yeah.
So you showed that graph of like the increasing privatization quantification, like that green circle.
Yeah.
That's what a lot of people recommend. Can you expand on what this means?
Expand on this, the green governance paradigm? Yeah. The logic is this. Production causes a lot of problems that are expensive. And a simple example is you cut down a forest and you make money from the trees. And that's the end of the story if you're the person cutting down the trees, right? You've got your trees, you've got your money, everything's hunky-dory. Nonetheless, the hillside you've just cut down is now subject to erosion and subject to water quality problems, flooding, and the impacts make their way downstream and they affect other people. And maybe it means that other people have to move their houses out of the floodplain. Maybe it means they have to drill deeper wells to reach water that's still safe to drink. All of those costs are not borne by the person who cut down the timber. And the argument is we should make them bear those costs. We should figure out what those costs are, and we should impose them on the person who cut down the timber. And if they can't make money bearing those costs, then they shouldn't have cut the trees down in the first place, right? All of that makes perfect sense. It all fits together in a nice intuitive package. Internalize the externalities, the external costs of various kinds of production. The question is, can you actually do it? How would you do it? There are issues for which this has been done in various ways and with some success. But there are also a lot of areas where people have tried very, very hard to figure out how you would do this. There's a lot of money going into how you would do this for water quality problems in the United States, for example. And the problem is that, in fact, these metrics, these indicators, it's extremely difficult. First, to figure out how you should measure the problem in the first place. You know, yes, you might be able to calculate the costs downstream, but can you actually assign those costs per tree, right? Or assign them across the entire watershed? Can you say, well, this hill slope is responsible for this much cost, and that hill slope and that farm field are responsible for these costs and that sort of thing? Then, even if you can do that, you have to create a so-called market in those permits to cut down those trees, for example, or cut down trees in that watershed. And that market has to be set up by translating all of these measurements into prices and erecting a regulatory system that will somehow serve as the clearinghouse, the point of exchange, for the permits among the people who benefit from cutting the trees down and connecting that somehow to the people whose water supplies are at stake. And to assume that you can do this on a scale adequate to the problem, even as technologies change, economic circumstances change, what counts as an appropriate price will change, that's an enormous assumption to make. So the intuitive beauty of this masks an enormous amount of practical complexity that is far, far, far greater than the ecology, let alone the economics that we currently know and understand, can catch up with. Other questions? All right. Thanks so much. Oh, questions at the last second? How much time we got? All right, more questions. You had one? Yeah.
Can you explain how globalization might make everyone unemployed?
No, not to make everyone unemployed. To make the world effectively have a single labor force that is subject to the dynamics that Marx described for the reserve army of the unemployed. In other words, if labor were to become substitutable on a global scale, such that you here in the United States with your skill set are forced to compete with basically not everybody else in the world, but an essentially global market of people with that skill set who can be connected through computers and telephones and so forth, such that their location no longer matters for production. In other words, all of you are sort of equally part of the same labor market, then you have the potential for a global reserve army of the unemployed. Now, obviously that's subject to all kinds of stickinesses and geographical variations and so forth, but in theory, that's the kind of circumstance that might be the endpoint of these globalizing economies. And there was, yeah.
From the beginning of the lecture with on the discussion about Sen and the idea that one of the most effective ways to sort of affect population growth is through education. And in turn, in these poorer countries, it's easier because of the low cost of doing it, of paying the
yeah.
wages and stuff. But that kind of stands in contrast or in contradiction to this other idea that was presented about investors defending their investments and that there are people who have an interest in keeping the wages low in a given country or a given place, and they might intervene to prevent things such as education and whatnot to happen.
Well, it's true that employers have an interest in low wages, but Sen's point about the labor intensivity of social service provision being a good thing with respect to being able to afford to make investments in poor countries stands independently of that. Because there's no law that says just because you're providing better education and health care, the price of labor is necessarily going to go up in that location, right? The goal might eventually be greater productivity, which might eventually mean higher wages. But I don't believe there's any reason to think that the investments of private entities in the built environment in the third world are directly threatened by the provision of the kinds of social services that Sen is talking about. Sen's simply trying to address the question, can third world governments reasonably afford to make the kinds of investments that he's describing? And his point is, just because they're poor doesn't mean they can't. Does that make sense? All right. Thanks so much.